streets are screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we got to comment on presidential actions. I'm not just talking about Trump, of course. It's all in the news, the firing of FBI Director Comey. Well, we'll weigh in on that and give our opinion as it relates to economic developments. And it is integrated with economics, of course. We will see how and what the consequences of this are and where we're going. But I also want to make some comments on the other president over there in France, Emmanuel Macron. We've had some shows here recently with some guests talking about that election. And, of course, he did win the election over there. And as the guest and I have had discussed his program, what is his likely program? Well, it's pretty obvious he came right out of the box, Macron, showing that or proposing anti-labor market reforms. I say anti-labor because that's what they are. His first public declaration, by the way, was all about implementing the anti-labor reforms. What are those reforms? Well, those are the eliminate or restrict collective bargaining, give employers a significant right to fire and get rid of workers, discharge workers, cut back on benefits, and so forth. You see, in France and most of Europe, there's this two-tier system, as we have here as well, and that is second-class citizen workers, part-time, temp, contract, etc., and they don't have any rights when they work part-time or temporary. A different set of labor laws apply to them. Employers can fire them at will and pretty much just do whatever they want with them. You've got the regular full-time traditional labor force, which has a lot of protections. Well, French employers and European employers, not strangely, have been hiring just those workers that they can do whatever they want with, the part-time temp contingent, as we call it, contingent labor. If you look at the hiring since the crisis over in Europe, they claim 5 million people have been hired. Well, it ranges from 60 to 80%, depending on the country, the proportion of part-time temp contingent hires in that total. So it's virtually all part-time temp and independent contract hiring over there. And that's how the employers have gotten around having to adhere to the more progressive, stricter labor law conditions for the full-time workers. Well, naturally, you know, the business elites over there are saying, you know, we have to have the same right with these full-time workers. We, our rights, in other words, to hire, fire, and limit collective bargaining and the right to strike and so forth for full-time. We've got to get rid of these labor laws here, or we'll just keep hiring the part-timers, you see. That's the way they put pressure on the government and the politicians. And labor law reform is the vehicle for doing that. You know, just to digress a little bit, we know in the U.S. We've had big problems with the labor market, hiring, again, mostly part-time temp at lower wage, no benefits, and so forth. Same phenomenon over here. We hear a lot about free trade and automation or replacing labor with capital equipment and machinery and so forth. And yes, that has led to a big loss of jobs in the U.S. About the same effect. Free trade has whacked off 3, 4, 5 million jobs in the last couple of decades, and automation, about the same. And of course, we know Trump is talking about free trade, not doing much, and saying and doing nothing about automation and the destruction of jobs as a result of that. And then his son-in-law goes around, and this came out this past week, in pushing his company and his business interests, proposing, you know, in Asia that if you want to come to the U.S., you can buy your citizenship on a fast track with bring $500,000, right? And that's okay. That kind of labor importation's okay. And in previous sessions here, we've also mentioned that the H-1B Trump proposals were just token and not real. So we're going to continue to get immigration, high-wage immigration coming into the U.S., while Trump keeps talking about the low-pay S-1 low-skilled coming in from Latin America and elsewhere, you know, ignoring H-1B, and of course Kushner here talking about, come on over, business people, we'll give you a fast track, just bring $500,000 and invest in my company. All right, enough for that digression. The point here simply being that we have a problem, yes, with immigration labor, but the bigger problem is with the transformations going on in the labor markets, you see. Not much talk about that. And, of course, the transformation focuses on the destruction of full-time permanent jobs with benefits and higher wages and its replacement with part-time temp contract, independent contract, gig, and so forth. That's going on. Now, how is that destroying jobs? Well, it's destroying them by creating only part-time, low-paid temp jobs. That's how. You know, you take a full-time job and you break it down into two part-timers. It saves 20-30% of labor costs for businesses, and they love that. And that's a problem. That's a problem here in the U.S. It's not just foreign free trade. It's not just technology displacing jobs. Yes, those things are significant, but it's also the restructuring of the labor markets in the U.S., and we get all this part-time, temp, low-paid stuff. Well, in Europe, the same thing. And in Japan, the same thing. You see, the business elites follow each other. They're global. And they do the same thing everywhere. Well, that's a bigger issue even in Europe. And it's behind, you know, a lot of this economic discontent with globalization, as they say. Well, in Europe, globalization means immigration. And people see these other folks coming in, taking their jobs, and the jobs that they're seeing are part-time, temp, low-paid. All right. So in France, we have this battle going on. And Macron, the new president, from the very beginning promised he was going to carry the water for the business elites on that. Just as his ex-party, the so-called Socialist Party, had under Hollande, had done the same thing. So, you know, just a continuation of that policy. Now, a comment on the election there. You get reports in the press 65% voted for Macron, and, you know, only barely 30-some percent, high 30s for Le Pen. Right. Okay, but a lot of that was a crossover protest vote for Macron. And if you look at the eligible labor force, well, let's say voting electorate, not labor force, in France, you had 25% who abstained altogether. And you had, you know, another percent, significant percent who voted and voted, you know, with blank ballots or voted with writing obscenities on the ballots, so the ballots were discontinued. So you have, if you add in the abstentions in the voting of the eligible labor force, then this guy, Macron, has only got 40% of the French vote, right? Not the 65% is of those who actually voted or didn't despoil their ballots or didn't submit a blank ballot. So it's really an overestimate. There really is no mandate for Macron. And Macron, of course, represents the effort by the French business elite to pull a Tony Blair, Bill Clinton. In other words, the policy strategy of the 90s was to get a nice young face and have him talk liberal and get him in office there, and then they would do the neoliberal policies, which were, of course, both Bill Clinton and Tony Blair did, Tony Blair being the Prime Minister of Britain at the time, who, by the way, is running around now getting big bucks consulting for the Saudis and others around the world. They're paying him off nicely. And if you talk about payoffs, well, how about Obama? A $400,000 speech that he's going to give here. And, you know, that's the way the business elite reward their friends in high places in government once they leave the government, you see. And it's all perfectly legal, perfectly legal. But anyway, you know, back to France. Macron's now in office. And the first thing he does coming out of the block here is to say, okay, we're going to go after this anti-labor reform for the French business elite, who, by the way, also put out a public announcement indicating that's their first priority. We'll talk about their priorities a little bit more here shortly. So, you know, Macron's in sync with the French business elite. They're the ones put him in power over there. Now, why? Why is this big push for anti-labor law reform going on in France and throughout Europe? You know, they've already implemented it in Spain, and the next big target, and of course Greece, and next big target is Italy. And this guy Renzi can't get it, seem to get it pushed through. It's a little harder in Italy because it's more fragmented. The political scene is more fragmented, and the business elite is not as unified or as strong as they are elsewhere in Europe and the U.S. Okay, so what's behind this? What's behind this anti-labor reform, which is really a euphemism for let's restructure the labor markets so we can put a lid and reduce wages here. Right? Put a lid on wage increases. Well, if you look at Europe, the problem is they can't grow their economy internally with real domestic investment. The exception to that, of course, is Germany, because of the way Germany dominates the whole euro system now in the post-1999 period where they created the euro. It was created to really benefit Germany and the Netherlands, Belgium, and France. Well, Germany and, to some extent, the Netherlands have been the great beneficiaries of the euro system at the expense of the periphery in the European eurozone, where the euro dominates, not the European Union. That's a customs union, a trade union, trades, export, import, trades. Okay, so the creation of the euro really was to the benefit of the Germans. You know, it's the banking interests that run the show there in the European Union and the Eurozone in particular. So we've got this push for labor reform that has to be understood as a way of putting a lid and depressing wages. Now, what are they trying to depress wages in France? Well, it's the full-time protected labor force segment that they're going after. They've already, you know, driven wages and incomes down in the part-time temp contingent sector, but in the protected sector, which is what they're going after, you see, they haven't been able to do that yet, but this is the whole objective here. Europe has failed, except for Germany, to develop real domestic internal investment. So it has turned in the last 15 years towards trying to stimulate domestic output, production, GDP, whatever, through exports. It's become or tried to become an export-driven economy, sector of the global economy, right? That's exactly what Germany did, dominated exports internally within the Eurozone, big beneficiary of export trade within the Eurozone, and its production for export trade, internal and external in the case of Germany, that has driven the German economy. So Germany wants to keep that whole situation exactly as it is. They don't want changes. They've been benefiting greatly at the expense of the rest of the Eurozone, but nonetheless, they don't want to change that. Okay, and it's because of the whole export-driven focus of the Eurozone and Germany. Okay, now, how do you stimulate your exports? If it's an export-driven investment production sector now instead of internal investment, how do you do that? Well, you make your exports more competitive. In other words, less costly, where your prices are more competitive than your other global competitors. Right? You steal exports in the global trade picture from your competitors. That's what export-driven strategy is. Drive your costs down, keep your prices down, and stimulate your exports that stimulate production for exports and therefore your economy. That's what export-driven trade strategy is all about. It's worked for the Germans internally and externally, right? And it's become the mantra, the economic mantra of Europe. Now, France has not benefited that much from that. So the whole idea of labor law reform that the Germans are pushing everywhere in Europe is to drive down your labor costs in order to stimulate your exports. You see, Germany did it, got an advantage within the Eurozone, and Germany and its allies in Northern Europe, the Dutch and so forth, are demanding all the other countries do the same thing. France is on board. This guy Hollande before embraced that wholeheartedly, and they're trying, as I said, they've already done it in Spain, but they're trying to do it in Greece. They're trying to do it in Italy. They haven't got there yet. But now with this guy Macron, they got a new lease on life here to push this export-driven strategy by reducing wages, by attacking the privileged sector of the labor force, the full-time workers still, and government workers that still haven't been totally as exploited as the part-time contingent workers have been. Okay. That's what anti-labor reform, labor law reform, is all about in Europe. And now we're really seeing its emergence here at a new level in France. This is called internal devaluation, a strategy of internal devaluation. What's the difference between external and internal devaluation? Well, external devaluation is when countries simply reduce by various means, monetary or other means, the exchange rate for their currency. You see, I can get a cost advantage over you, my competitors, by simply lowering the value of my currency. That's one technique for doing it. That's external devaluation. But if you're in the Eurozone and you're stuck with this common currency, you can't do that. You can't engage in external devaluation because you have no control over the currency. Who controls the currency in the Eurozone? It's the European Central Bank, which has been pretty much dominated, although somewhat less so in recent years, by this German coalition, German finance ministers with their allies in Netherlands and elsewhere, Eastern Europe, little countries, economies that depend on German trade and so forth. They've dominated the what's called the General Council of the European Central Bank. Right? And they really control what the value of the euro is. To some extent, of course, the ECB has been pumping so much money into the economy because of the crisis of the European economy. That has lowered the exchange rate for the euro. But individual countries can't do that, you see. It all has to come through the ECB and pretty much has to get the okay of the German coalition to do that. So France can't engage in an external devaluation of its currency to get an export competitive advantage to grow its economy. The way that these countries attempt to get an export competitive advantage is to reduce the costs of their products and reduce the labor costs, the wages of those products in particular. That's called an internal devaluation. Internal, right? Attack wages and other costs, but primarily wages, to drive down the price of your product so you capture a bigger share of the global export trade. That's what this whole labor law reform is about, to attack wages in the full employment privilege sector that remains in France and other countries too. And what better way that to lower wages is than to pretty much destroy collective bargaining so the unions can't negotiate wage increases, get rid of the right to strike, as well as change the collective bargaining rules so that the unions and workers can't pressure for higher wages, and create more unemployment in the full employment sector. How do you create more employment in full employment sector? The labor law reforms would allow employers to fire workers more at will. So you eliminate the right to strike, you undermine collective bargaining conditions, and you give employers the right to fire full-time workers, just as they do discharge at will part-time temp workers. You see, it's to lower the levels here to of the full-time workers in France to the part-time temp workers in France. Now, instead of raising the levels of the contingent workers to the full-time benefits, it's lower them to so you know, think of it this way: this part-time temp phenomenon in the labor markets of the advanced economies plays the same role on compressing wages in general, as does the free trade, and as does the replacement of labor with automation and capital. You see, it's a triple whammy here. You hear a lot of talk about the free trade, and now you're beginning to hear talk about the automation and replacement, but you don't hear that much talk about how this contingent labor force restructuring also compresses wages. It certainly compresses compensation being wages plus the value of benefits, because the part-time contingent workers have virtually no benefits. That certainly reduces total compensation levels. But even the wage levels here, are hourly wages, outright wages, are compressed. In other words, not allowed to rise. So you don't have to really outright reduce it, drive wages down. You just don't let them rise over a longer period of time, and that's tremendous savings for businesses. So we have this triple whammy going on in the U.S. and elsewhere of free trade and automation and grow this contingent labor force. And in France, labor law reforms are really to convert the full-time labor force to conditions suffered by the contingent labor force. Okay, create this two-tier workforce. And as I said, that's the pressure has been put on the governments over there by the business elite by simply hiring virtually only part-time temp contingent labor in Europe for the last, the 6-7 years since 2008, right? Now, it's interesting that the unemployment rates, both in the U.S. and Europe, do not adequately reflect the real loss of jobs by converting full-time to part-time temp jobs. Doesn't reflect it accurately. Here in the U.S., full-time employment and unemployment is measured by what's called the U3 unemployment rate. This is the one you hear trumpeted in the press. Oh, it's only 4.5%. Oh, we got full employment and so forth. But when you add the underemployed, the part-time temp contingent, it's about 9%. And even that is an underestimation. You know, even the 9%, when you pick up the part-time temp and people drop out, it doesn't count the people who have left the labor force and gone on disability. And it doesn't count the growth of the shadow economy that's not picked up, in inner cities and people working off the books and so forth. That's underemployment as well. And it doesn't pick up, survey methods don't really pick up the itinerant workers who move around from job to job. And then I won't go into detail, but I've always had a heartburn with the statistical method in the U.S. called the new business formation, which assumes a certain amount of jobs created every time a small business is added to the economy, and that's not an actual number of people. They don't know exactly what the number is, but they make an assumption, and then 9 months later, it's added to the unemployment rate and the level of employment as well. Rather than go into detail, this whole new business formation thing, adjustment thing, is, I think, inaccurate. So the point is all these measures would really add further unemployment, maybe 2%, 3%, I would say at least, to the official unemployment rates. In the U.S., the official full-time at 4.5%. When you add the underemployed of various kinds, you get about 9%. But then I would add 2-3% for these other hidden unemployed elements that I call. So, you know, we're really like 10-12% unemployed in the U.S. Now, in Europe, it's even worse. The underreporting is even worse. Europe's official unemployment rate is 9.5% right now. It peaked at 12% in 2013, and now it's down to 9.5%. Now that's across Europe. Right? You still got 25 plus percent unemployment, and in the periphery in places like Greece, almost 20% in Italy, etc., in Spain, etc. So you know that's factoring in very low unemployment in Germany, and averaging it out with these other countries. This 9.5%, but this 9.5%. Is equivalent roughly to the U.S.'s U3 unemployment rate, you know, the 4.5% in the U.S. And as I said, when you add the U6 unemployment rate, the underemployed in the U.S., you get closer to 10%. And really, if you add the hidden unemployed, which isn't in official calculations, you get about 12%. So the U.S. is about 12%. Well, what about Europe? Well, recently a study came out. And it said that the true unemployment rate in Europe, if you count the underemployed, right, is really about 18%. 18. And that's an average that includes the low levels in Germany. 18%. You know, our true unemployment rate's 10 to 12%. And the European Central Bank, not a radical source, estimates 18%. Study just came out. And that's because they're even more conservative than the U.S. for counting whether you are unemployed or not. You see, in the U.S., you're not unemployed just because you don't have a job. You're unemployed if you're out of work and you looked for a job in the preceding 4 weeks. That's what this U3 unemployment, 4.5%, is really about. If you're jobless but you didn't look in the last 4 weeks in the U.S., you're not considered unemployed. Talk about oxymorons, right? All right. Well, what about in Europe? According to Eurostat, even more conservative, if you haven't looked for a job in the last 2 weeks, you're not part of that 9.5%. Okay, so, you know, a lot of people are unemployed and didn't look in 2 weeks. That's the 18% in Europe. Okay, so you got 18% in Europe and you know, 9 to 12% here in the U.S. That's a lot of unemployment 7 years after the so-called end of the recession. In Italy, by the way, this 18% is really 30%. 30%. Now, that's not counting youth unemployment. The numbers go up even more. 40 to 50% of the youth in Italy have no work or their pickup jobs here or there. Right? Very similar in the U.S., you know, our youth unemployment's probably, you know, 25, 30%. And minority youth unemployment closer to 50. Right. This is no recovery in terms of the job markets. Now, what this high level of real unemployment means is that there's poor income growth. Right, and the growth in levels of income is the primary determinant of consumption demand. And if consumption demand is not recovering or only recovering at the high end, so it looks like on an average you're getting consumption recovery, but if you really looked at the median, you would not see consumption recovery. Poor consumption based on poor income growth, based on poor wage growth, means that you have less internal investment. In other words, businesses, if they don't see income growth and they don't see consumption internally within the internal economy, they don't invest in the internal economy. If they don't invest, productivity becomes stagnant, which it is. Which means that they then turn to external exports as a way of growing production. They can't grow it internally, so they invest and expand production for reasons of export to get the cost, price, a competitive advantage for their exports. They then engage in internal devaluation, i.e. drive wages down. And to do that, you need labor reform. You see, we've already done the, quote, labor reform here in the U.S., right? And no one resisted it. It's been happening for a couple of decades now. Well, in Europe, they're just in the process of implementing this in different countries over the last decade. So you see where labor law reform, anti-labor reform fits in this whole scenario of stimulating economic growth by exports because you're not reinvesting in your own economy because there isn't enough consumption, because there isn't enough wage and income growth. It becomes a vicious cycle, self-serving cycle, a downward cycle. And that's what Europe's trapped in, and we are too. In other words, I guess I'm saying it's not just that we have wage compression because of free trade and automation. We have wage compression because employers are refusing to hire full-time people and are instead on their own hiring part-times and temps and contingent, transforming the whole labor markets. The problem with this export-driven growth strategy that I've just described for in Europe and Japan too, right, is that if you implement this in the context of slowing global trade anyway, it becomes a bigger your neighbor strategy because other countries do the same thing. It's quite evident if we look at Japan and Europe, where they are together attempting to drive down the cost of their exports by devaluing their currency, which is one way of doing it, as I said, by pumping in so much money from their central bank, quantitative easing does that. It drives down the value of your currency because you've got excess money supply. So what we got got going on in Europe is both an internal and an external devaluation going on. And as Europe desperately tries to recover from 2008-09 crash by driving exports. But in the context of slowing global trade, that's not a very effective way or efficient way of doing it. Doing it, it meaning recovery. Export-driven growth is not a solution to recovery from the 2008-09 crash. Okay. But that's what's going on, and that's what's behind all this labor law reform talk in France. The Germans are saying that, and have been saying to the French and others, get on board. We drove down our wages in 2005 to get our competitive advantage within the Eurozone, which we did successfully achieve. And by dominating the European Central Bank, we can also drive down the value of the euro and get an advantage because we are our economy, German economy, half of GDP is exports. Half. Very dependent on exports. So Germany has driven Europe into this export-driven strategy, which requires not just external devaluation of the currency, but internal devaluation by wage compression, which requires labor law reform. But the problem there is it keeps wages and income growth lower, too low, to stimulate internal investment, which becomes an argument for even more internal devaluation and export-driven strategy. So you see, it's a vicious cycle that never ends. Now, the business elite, as I said earlier, has this as its number one strategy here, priority, I would say. And they read the business press, that's what they're saying. Come on, Macron, we need this labor reform. Now you can do it, right? You got the mandate, 65%. No, you only got 40, right? And as I've said, and guests on the show said, the fight in France now is going to move to the workplace level, not the electoral level, over this. Now, the second major proposal of the French business elite is to reduce corporate taxes. Does that sound familiar? Yes, everywhere. Everywhere, the corporate elites are demanding more and more tax cuts as they race to the bottom competitively in that regard as well. See, they're racing to the bottom by cutting wages and incomes to get a share, a bigger share of a shrinking global volume trade. And they're in a race to the bottom, cutting corporate and business investor taxes everywhere. Okay. Third priority, privatize. Business elite saying to Macron, sell off. And Macron is saying, yeah, we're going to sell off these government investments in businesses. We don't have that over here in the U.S. As much. But in Europe, you have had government investing, owning stock shares of a lot of utility companies, of power companies, nuclear power companies, of airline companies, and so forth. In France, there's like 1,750 companies that the government has some stock stake in, has invested in, bailing them out, subsidizing them over the years, right, and taking a position. So that's why there's $110 billion of government investment in the French businesses. Okay. By the way, U.S. bankers and bankers and global bankers are also on board here with the French business elite demanding labor reform. There's a lot of talk about banks leaving London with this Brexit and moving to Paris. Well, the bankers are saying, well, before we move to Paris, you've got to do this labor law reform. I'm referring to Jamie Dimon of Chase here in the U.S. publicly came out recently and said that, oh, okay, Macron, you've got to deliver on this labor reform before we move the chase from London to Paris. By the way, 70% of the French public opinion opposes these anti-labor market reform measures. The elites don't care what people's popular attitudes are. They do what they want anyway. You know, they run elections and they say they're going to do things because that's what they think people want to hear, and then they just go and do what their money bags and benefactors really demand of them. And we've seen it, of course, here with Trump. You know, I've recently written this piece, Is Trump Really President? And summarized his 100 days and his turnaround on all the measures, virtually all the measures he ran, populist measures, during the campaign. You know, I had predicted back in November on my blog, jackrasmus.com, that they would tame Trump, but I didn't think they'd tame him this quick. It was easy. It was easy. He's done a turnabout on all these economic measures because the U.S. business elite, what they want more than anything else, like the French elite, is tax cuts. You know, they don't need the labor market reform here. It's already been implemented in the U.S. So at the top of their list becomes the tax cuts, corporate tax cut rates. The French business elite has proposed to Macron they reduce the corporate tax rate to 25%, right, from 30-something. Well, that's probably where they're going to end up here as well in the U.S. You know, this 35% top corporate tax figure, tax rate, they'll reduce that to 25, maybe even 20. You know, they'll start with 25, and it'll be a multi-year thing, and they'll reduce it down to 20. Probably. They won't get it to 15, but they get it to at least to 2025. As part of this race to the bottom, everywhere. Lift all the taxes on corporations and investors, including speculators. Right? Yeah. All right, so there's a similarity there. You see, these policies are not different across these different sectors of the global economy. They're virtually the same. Right? In Japan, the same thing. Wages have median wages have been declining every year, 1 to 2% for at least a decade now. Right? You got wage compression going on everywhere: U.S., Japan, Europe. And then they wonder why you can't get consumption going unless you increase access to debt. You see, that's the only way most people can expand consumption nowadays. But, you know, there's a limit to that because you got to pay it back. And that reduces your real wages in the future. It's just debt and credit is just a way of transferring spending in the future to the present that you pay for later. But that's what's driving a lot of what exists in terms of consumption. It's not being driven like it was in the initial post-World War II period by rising wage incomes. It's being driven by debt. Which has its limits, you see. Okay, so which brings us kind of to the U.S. here. Like the French business elite, the U.S. business elite want tax cuts first and foremost. Now, Trump and Congress are all on board with that. You know, there's no difference with them. And that's number one priority. But to get that number one priority, they got to get this Obamacare reform out of the way, which includes a $592 billion tax cut, you know, for investors and businesses and wealthy. Yeah, $592 billion. That's why they've hated this ACA all along here. And it's just a debate over, you know, what public relations features are they going to keep of the ACA, you know, like lifetime coverage and, you know, pre-existing conditions and stuff like that. You know, that's all you hear about. But you don't hear about the fact they're cutting $592 billion. You know, you don't hear about that much in the media, at least the mainstream media. But that's really what this thing labor law repeal and reform is all about, you see, at least as far as the business interests are concerned. They don't like paying these taxes that they had to pay. But as soon as they get this thing out of the way here and get a compromise on the ACA, which they will before summer, then the next thing is this $2 trillion-plus Trump preliminary tax cut proposal. You know, he came out with this one-pager before, a couple weeks ago. But watch for the full budget coming out on May 23rd. Then we'll see what he's really proposing on these tax cuts for businesses. Reducing the business top corporate tax rate from 35 to 15. As I said, they'll probably end up somewhere between 20 and 25 on that. Now, that's the tax rate. That's not the effective tax that they actually pay. Multinational corporations pay about 12 to 15%. Not all of them even pay that, but that's the average. The effective tax rate for multinational corporations is about 12 to 15%. So if you reduce the tax rate, the nominal tax rate, from 35 to 25 or 20, well, that 12 to 15% will probably be single-digit taxation for corporations and investors. That's what's coming. And to pay for it, you know, they're going to get rid of or try to get rid of your middle-class deductions and exemptions. You know, you won't be able to claim state income tax payments or mortgage payments, mortgage interest and stuff like that. They can make the middle class pay for the big tax cuts for the rich and the investors. That's what the Trump thing is all about. But they're all on board with that, you see. They're all on board. Now, I don't agree with Paul Krugman about a lot of things, but he did come out with an editorial today where he says, he talks about the tax cuts and the, quote, great betrayal by the Republicans. And what is the great betrayal? Well, Republicans have always been strong on patriotism and strong on foreign policy and anti-Russian and so forth, right? That's always been a hallmark of a Republican policy, as well as tax cuts. Well, what Krugman is saying here is that, look, Republicans apparently don't care about Russian interference in elections or deals between the Trump administration and the Russians that we don't know anything about yet. They're willing to overlook that. Republicans are in Congress in order to get the tax cuts, you see. As he says, Krugman says, quote here, a quote from his column, two leading Republicans in Congress, he's talking about the in the House, House Leader Ryan and McConnell, Senate Leader, because Republicans have a majority in both houses, right? Two leading Republicans in Congress are apparently okay with that cover-up. In other words, they're going along with the covering up of the whole investigation of the Trump-Russian connection here. Back to the quote. Because the Trump ascendancy is giving them the chance to do what they always wanted, namely take health insurance away from millions of Americans while slashing taxes on the wealthy. In other words, what Krugman is saying is that their priority is money. Their priority is the tax cuts, and they're willing to go along maybe with some hanky-panky here between Trump administration and the Russians before the election here. All right, so that's I kind of agree with them on that. That's what it's about. You know, money comes first with these folks. In other words, almost the entire party appears to have decided that potential treason in the cause of tax cuts for the wealthy is no vice. Quote, unquote. Yeah, well, you got it right this time, Paul. Right. Is there a Russian connection with the Trump regime? Oh, yeah, of course there is. across the board, and many many members. I mean, Kushner has some connections there. Jeff Sessions has connections. And what about these shadowy figures? Paul Manafort, you know, who was the campaign advisor of Trump? Well, yeah, they do. How much? Well, that's what they're trying to cover up, you see. That's what they're trying to cover up. And it's pretty obvious. That's why Trump fired this Comey guy, you know, the FBI director. He was asking for more power from Congress to go deeper into the investigation of the connections here during the election period and perhaps afterwards as well. But I have to admit, I do find it strange that apparently Trump's connections during an election are a serious breach of the laws in the U.S. regarding treason or whatever you have, consorting with. We're not at war with Russia. I don't know why, that's considered particularly illegal. It may not be illegal. I don't know the law that well, but maybe it is. But, just hearken back to another president who did the same thing back in 1980, Ronald Reagan. You know, the whole Iran affair is pretty clear that Reagan and his staff and so forth approached the Iranians, who were holding U.S. hostages at the time of the 1980 election, hundreds of U.S. hostages that they had taken. And this is a fact that there were communications and so forth, and the Iranians were convinced by Reagan's team before the election not to release the hostages. You know, Carter was desperately trying to cut a deal to get the hostages released, and apparently Reagan cut his own deal, and they didn't release the hostages until Reagan got elected, and then they quickly released them, you see. So, you know, what was all this about? And how about the affair under Reagan where in violation of laws, congressional laws in Central America, to arm the Contras, in other words, the landowners' troops, who were fighting against the democratically elected popular government at the time in Nicaragua. It was illegal to provide arms to these people. So what did the Reagan administration do? They got arms from Iran and got the Israelis to buy the arms from Iran and to distribute it. And the U.S. paid the bill, of course, to the Contras. Well, you know, I mean, that was circumventing laws, you know, by the president and so forth and his staff, you know, just like going to the Iranians and cutting a deal before the election. But no one went after Reagan. Well, there was a little, you know, huff and puffing going on and so forth, but the media did not attack Reagan the way they're attacking Trump. Now, I'm not making an excuse for it, but, the arrangement of forces within the ruling elite in this country have shifted dramatically since then. Dramatically. You got internecine warfare going on between segments of the U.S. elite. Both the economic and political elites, but mostly the political elites here, right? You got this guy Trump who threatened to change the direction of U.S. foreign policy, neoliberal foreign policy, and threatened to make other changes in policy direction that the established elites just did not want to accept. And, then he engaged in a very acrimonious kind of campaign, slamming the other wing of the elite and their media. So, you know, they've been at each other tooth and tong here, growing over the period, of recent years, but, you know, coming to a culmination here. This has erupted, you see, erupted in this political infighting going on, What's going to be interesting after this Comey affair is whether we're going to start seeing leaks again from the intelligence establishment about Trump and what Trump's going to do about that. I predict that we're going to have a continuation of leaks and so forth, and the established elite media, you know, the New York Times, Washington Post, and those folks are going to continue hammering on Trump, and Trump's going to give him a lot of easy ammunition with his dumb tweets. You know, he's playing right in the hands of these people. You know, as I said in my article, is Trump really president? On my blog, jackrasmus.com, I think what we have here is the strangest form of presidency in a long time. You know, presidents don't have the power that the people think they have, because the system is set up where the elites check those powers in a number of ways. It's not just checks and balances, formal government, but a lot of informal ways as well that they keep these presidents in line. But this guy, Trump, is... you know, the least actual president that we've ever had. You know, I think he's content to sit up there on the second floor of the White House and do his tweeting and calling his wealthy friends at night, you know, as he does, and, you know, how am I doing kind of thing, conversations, giving tours, four-hour tours to people in the White House, his friends, right? He comes down and he signs executive orders after executive order, a lot of PR and media and so forth, right? And he gives one-on-one interviews to reporters, you know, and then he goes down to Mar-a-Lago. I think he wants to be a figurehead president, you know, but he can't keep his mouth shut. And he's making it difficult for himself to even function that way. Who's running the U.S. government? Well, you know, Goldman Sachs is running the economic side of the policy of the government. That's clear. You know, they're in all key positions, Treasury and so forth. And the generals are running foreign policy, you know, along with Tillerson, big oil man. Domestic policy, you know, Trump keeps playing around with that. Immigration and et cetera, right? But, okay, you play with that as long as you deliver, you know, the deregulation, deliver the tax cuts, and don't mess with free trade. You can tweak it, renegotiate it, but don't mess with it. That's what the elites are telling him. And he's going along with that. And they're letting him engage in all that civil stuff, you know, with immigration and so forth. And that's the agreement between them. I believe, except that he can't keep his mouth shut, and he makes it harder and harder for them to carry out this government by committee. You know, I mean, it's the intelligence community plus the generals, plus Goldman Sachs and the bankers. They're the ones really running this government. And periodically, you know, he makes it difficult. The traditional elites are keep pushing him on his Russia connection and his taxes and so forth, and he loses his cool, and he slashes out, as he did with firing this Comey guy. Are they going to impeach him? Not until after the 2018 elections at the earliest, if that. There will be no removal of this guy till he delivers, because that's what they want. You see, they'll put up with him until they get what they want from him, and then if he can't keep his mouth shut, you know, they'll either take impeachment proceedings against him, which aren't going to happen because it originates in the Senate. That's not going to happen until these benefits get passed, and, you know, the trials come in the House. That's not going to happen. You know, so there'll be no impeachment, but they'll build the case for the next 2 years. So next week, we'll look at the U.S. economy once again in more detail and try to understand where it's going, where it likely will go. Okay, that's it for today. This is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.